I'll just introduce us in case you wandered in not knowing which workshop you came to. My name is Susan. I'm a compulsive eater. I am so grateful to be here. Hi. And this workshop is Commitment to Recovery through Steps 1, 2, and 3. My name's Susan, this is Gina and Margaret, and we're each going to speak up to 20 minutes on our reflections on that topic, and then leave the rest of the time open for others to either ask questions of us, reflect on this topic themselves, or, well, whatever. Anyway, thanks for being here. And Gina's going to start.
This always really scares me, so I'm just going to come out and just say that I'm looking out in this audience, and I am just seeing so many beautiful faces, and I'm grateful to be here in person. I've been in food recovery for 8.5 years. I came into a sister program January 27th of 2007, after another year of New Year's resolutions that didn't really stick. I notice a lot of us have January dates, but I came in to see how for the emotional sobriety. I came in September 10th of 2012, and where I felt that food recovery has really given me such a strong foundation in a program for daily living, see how has really given me my wings. So being asked to be of service is a privilege. And I live in an area where we don't yet have live meetings. I'm in the process of starting one. And so I'm really grateful for the opportunity to see your faces, because I've been on phone bridge and it's been wonderful. But there's something about the connection of looking out and seeing faces and not feeling so alone. And kind of finding my tribe, and that's where my recovery has really brought me today. So I was asked to lead this panel, well, to co-lead this panel, and I'm going first because I get so nervous talking in front of people. I've had a history of not having very great self-esteem and really not knowing my worth, and can become very intimidated in even finding my voice. But it is truly in practicing these steps and coming into food recovery, and it's just the funnel through which the rest of my life pours. So to be able to communicate that, which once felt like a curse, to not be able to stop eating for years, the pain and the isolation of growing up and stop feeling that zest for life, in more years of then getting depressed and the insanity of trying to do things a different way many, many times only to end up with the same result is so painful, so painful. So by the time I found 12-step recovery, I was 39 years old, and honestly, I was not a person who ever really practiced portion control. I thought I had a metabolism problem. I was always looking to food combine in specific ways that I could kind of get through the day, some days with greater ease than others. But on really bad days, which was an emotional day, I was just grateful to shut the door and to eat myself into oblivion. And that was really, I felt like that was kind of a good day just to shut the world out. I felt that food was my best friend for so many years, and it was my normal reaction to life. So by the time I came into food recovery, I was just curious enough to attend the meeting and to listen, but I didn't really know what I was getting into. Honestly, I just wanted to lose the weight. I mentioned earlier today, my weight loss is not that remarkable. I've lost and maintained about 30, 35 pounds weight loss, but my perception of life, the way I handled myself, the way I saw myself in relation to the world around me, I just turned to food to comfort, and it stopped working, as I'm sure many people have experienced. So, you know, I tried restricting, I wasn't that successful with bulimia, but, you know, as I got older, the weight came on, and it was just like my dirty little secret. I grew up in an Italian family, so food was love. Food was kind of the answer to a lot of things, and I loved to cook, and it was one of the ways that I connected with people. So it was terrifying to be thinking of giving that up or anybody messing with my food, but I did want relief, and, you know, I wanted just to read quickly. The big book talks about incomprehensible demoralization. And it was the first thing that I really read when I came into recovery that I thought, okay, I'm in the right place. Because it really did speak to how I'd been living and kind of unsuccessfully living for a long time. And this is from the big book, second edition, pages 30 and 31. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like any other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there have been brief recovery, followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do a right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats off are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. When I read that, I knew that I'd been playing this game for many, many, many years. And as I said, when I came into recovery, I was just curious enough to see what this was all about. Because while I still believed, as I was had put down the food and I was weighing and measuring and I was sitting and listening to the literature and to people describing what they were going through, I still wasn't sure that I was a food addict or compulsive eater. I just thought, you know, that I was without hope. And so it gave me a little bit of hope because step one talks about admitting that we're powerless. I had known for a long time that I was powerless. I just didn't know what I was powerless over. Like I said, when I came in, I thought it was my metabolism. So I was weighing and measuring, and I started to notice things were happening. It was in the experience of doing that that I became a little bit more curious. And I remember one day, I was supposed to, you know, I was doing my outreach calls. And at this point, I still thought outreach calls were for me to connect with other people and helping them. I didn't know. It was to help me. And I said, I don't know what's different about today than other days, but I feel like I'm in a black hole. And the fellow said to me, you know, this is where we know we can't do it alone. And she kind of welcomed me to talk more about that. And that was my first real connection between how I ate. And I ate violently. I just want to say, like, I didn't have any choice. I didn't feel like I had any choice. So to be able to put it down, to admit I was powerless, to name that I had felt really defeated, and to surrender it to the scale was a huge step. But I really felt that I was ready only because the pain of not doing so was so great. So I took really slow and baby steps. And step one, you know, it's where we start, but it's about being honest. It's that, you know, the how of the program, the H in the how. And I just love that, because being willing to tell the truth, not just to other people, but to myself, I was just really ready to change. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know, the sanity and the willingness to tell the truth. I didn't want to be alone. It was such a relief to hear that there's a solution. It's in surrender. I don't have to be alone doing it. I felt alone still. It was all still on a very intellectual level. But I just kept going with it. A lot of my beliefs that I came into program with are really, really outdated. And it's only been through just going through life in abstinence and just keep choosing to do the same thing each day and working the tools and weighing my food, reaching out. All the things that we do, it started to sink in and become a lifestyle. And it, you know, it wasn't easy. I didn't understand really what I was doing. But the belief that there was a solution, I mean, I think at the time I didn't even realize that it could be a solution for me. I knew it could be for other people. But I started watching the weight come off. And I have such body dysmorphia. I thought it was almost like I had this experience that the weight was not really coming off. It was like I would wake up the next day and my clothes were slightly bigger. You know, so that was weird. But I did start being able to pause. And I would go over things in my mind kind of obsessively, because I'm quite obsessive compulsive. And I can say that today as a term of endearment. But when I become fearful or resentful or anxious, I can just switch the light off, which really blocks me to my higher power. And I just can't hear or see anything. And I revert back to these old-fashioned, kind of outdated beliefs. And in those beliefs, I don't have a voice, you know? Those beliefs, I'm not deserving. You know, and when I go into that negative thinking, you know, it's that battering cycle, which always results into me feeling bad, not good enough, and that's what can lead me back to the food. And I knew I didn't want to go back to the food, so I'd stay another day. And I would go through all these mental calisthenics around it, because like I said, at first, it was really an intellectual process, but it led me, how much time do I have? 5 more minutes, okay. It led me in the surrender, the willingness to change my behavior, just because I wanted less pain, more pleasure. I think I still really wanted just to be thin and be in a normal body, because I believed that perhaps if I were in a normal size body, that all my problems would go away. And even after the weight came off, I was really shocked that I had the same kind of crappy days. And then I didn't even have food to eat over it. And that felt like really worse. I didn't know what to do about that. But that's where the tools came in, you know. And I was very, very lucky that I chose a sponsor that I felt a real connection to. I say more than anything, even though I have changed sponsors through the years a few times, finding somebody that you can trust or feel that you could build trust with, for me, that has been part of the foundation of my abstinence, because I can go to my sponsor and say, boy, I really screwed today up. You know, I don't feel like I necessarily had that relationship with her in the beginning, but I felt like it was almost more for me. As I started to really gain a sense of self-care, and that I was calming down in this body that had been so in fight or flight for so many years, I just started noticing I can pause, I can relax, I can start working on my relationships. I don't just have to be this like raw nerve roaming through the world. That gave me hope, because I was really interested in building relationships with people. I was really interested in this notion of higher power. You know, I was raised in the South, and I never really had a sense of a personal connection with higher power, but I could really kind of see, okay, I get it, the stars, the skies, the universe. You know, for me, I think the fellowship really became higher power for me for a while. And it's through the fellowship that I started understanding truly that I wasn't alone, and that if I believed that I had access to something greater than myself, that I could actually be in touch with that part of myself that really wanted to be alive, that had been buried underneath all that food for all those years. And that little tiny part that was still left in me, that spark has continued to grow since I've been in program. And I'm so grateful for that, really, because, you know, to not have huge weight loss, to be young and to look at my friends outside of program and say, I'm having these issues and I don't know what's wrong. And people just say, you know, like, good friends, but nobody really understood me the way that other people in program did. So the priority for me to put program first grew as the abstinence grew. And my desire to get that whole package of recovery beyond the physical relief, the mental obsession, that's when I put down the food, that's what I really had to start dealing with. And so, you know, maybe some people can just do it in just one little neat packaged way. For me, it wasn't. It came through a lot of tears, a lot of dead ends, some outside help that I kept just choosing every day, sometimes every hour, just to keep coming back. So that leads me to step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. So the second, I didn't mention it, but open-mindedness. You know, I was just curious and open enough just to stick around, to see the physical recovery, but then to start to see the benefits of the emotional sobriety, the mental calming down. You know, that was valuable to me. To be able to get out of my own way, to see when I was having trouble all day long with other people and I was thinking it was them, I started noticing, oh my gosh, my part, what am I doing? You know, and so my perceptions started changing. I felt less like a victim. I started seeing my own value in this world. And so made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I just know that like a light switch, I can wake up on the wrong side of the bed and I can have all this great understanding and be in the best mood and write a beautiful gratitude list and inspire people. And I can wake up the very next day and the light switch is off. I'm negative. I can't even, like, I'll even not even be aware that I'm in a bad mood, but I'll act out and be really bratty to other people. And so my sponsor first said, oh, making a decision. It's not like you're making a decision for your whole life. You're just making a decision in this moment. And you don't even have to go do anything. You can just make a decision right now just to wait. You can make a decision to take an action, but maybe use one of your tools. See if it's the right time. You know, so step three, when I get to that point and I'm making that decision and I'm just not really sure, I just go back to step one again. You know, it's that wash, rinse, repeat. You know, it's that foundation that has kept me abstinent. It's kept me coming back. It's why I'm so grateful to live my life today. I don't even think it really looks that different to people that have known me through the years. But from the inside out, I want my life today. I'm still a moody person and very highly sensitive. But all the tools really help me take care of myself. And even on a really crappy day, like I used to have really bad months, I've had bad years, I can usually, with the help of the fellowship and higher power, pull it back in, make a phone call, write about it. And something that I thought was like a huge deal, you know, in a few hours, I can't even remember what I was so upset about. You know, why would I not want to give that to myself? So I'm just going to wrap up by saying that it might sound easy. I've been through a year kind of unparalleled to other years that I've had in abstinence. I've gone through some high highs and some low lows. But one of the reasons that I love this program and love the honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness that See How stresses is that I'm perfect just as I am. I don't need to improve myself. I came here because I want to move into a place of self-acceptance. And I feel that this program has really given me the opportunity to be just where I am in my recovery and be met there, and that I don't have to constantly adjust myself to be something right for somebody else. And when I start there between myself and my higher power and my tools, I am anchored in this life now in a way that I just didn't have before. And it's nothing that food could have ever given me. And so I'm going to keep coming back. Thanks for letting me share.
Hi, my name is Margaret, and I'm a compulsive eater. Hi. Very grateful to be here. Can you hear me? Okay. And I had no idea how to prepare for this. But let me just qualify. I came into this program in May of 1998. And I've had many recommitments. But today, I have a recommitted abstinence of 1 year, 11 months, and 12 days. And I am maintaining a weight release of 114 pounds. And I'm also a full-service sponsor. And, you know, my story is really different. And I really don't want to be different anymore. I want to be one among many. But where I first came in contact with this program, it's a small area, and we had a few meetings, face-to-face meetings, but no one was really doing it the way it's written. I don't know how that happened, but that was my experience. It wasn't until years in the program that we, you know, people started getting outside sponsors, like from LA, that I found out I wasn't working this program the way it was written. So so it was a slow learning process for me. So actually, you know, I'm going to quote a really good friend of mine in this program. I heard her say this, and this was my exact experience. I came in for the vanity, and I stayed for the sanity. And I had no self-esteem, and all my life I've been told that that I have low self-esteem, but nobody ever told me how to get high self-esteem. And I'm multiply blessed. I am in other 12-step programs, and so CEA How was not my first rodeo. And so I found out in my first program, I heard a speaker say that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. So lucky for me, I had a sponsor in that program that tricked me into service very early. And I started feeling better about myself right away because I was doing things for other people. And so it was like, you know, that little light bulb that comes on and says, oh, yeah, oh, okay, that's what self-esteem is. Anyway, so I really was astounded at how quickly I lost the weight in this program. It just, and I wasn't a youngster when I got here. But let me just back up a little bit. What happened for me is I spent a lifetime of trying to be thin. I thought my problem was is that I could never be thin enough and I could never stay thin. I always had weight to lose. It might have been 10, 15 pounds, whatever. But and so when I came into my first 12-step program, I got sober. I gave myself permission to never diet again because I was a great dieter. I just couldn't stay on one. And I'm so glad that I made that decision because in hindsight, it was a good decision because what happened was as I hit a bottom, I knew I had a problem with food. I just didn't know what it was. And so I'll just tell you, I had an experience this morning on the way down to breakfast with another friend of mine who's in my we're roommates. And we were in the elevator, and this gentleman got on the elevator with us, and he was a large person. And I had seen this gentleman, and I thought he was one of us. But he started talking to us, and he said, so, he goes, there's some kind of a convention. And he asked what it was, and we told him. And he immediately, I could tell he wanted to run, but it was too late. The doors had already closed. So so we, you know, just gave him a brief, you know, you can go online if you're interested. And I don't know about you, but when I tell people, if someone asks me how I've lost the weight and I tell them I'm in a 12-step program, they start to defend their eating. I don't know if that's how, you know, well, I don't really eat that much sugar. I don't care. I didn't ask you for that. But anyway, so he started defending himself. And then what he did was he diverted himself. He diverted it and started talking about his brother. And he said his brother had had the bypass surgery. And he said, but, you know, it got rid of that problem, but now he has this problem. And my friend said, that's because the bypass surgery does not change the brain. That's it. And, you know, all those years that I was dieting, the reason they didn't work is because nothing changed up here. That's where it starts for me. You know, I have an obsession of the mind. So when I take that first compulsive bite, long before I take that first compulsive bite, what happens for me is I'm thinking about it for days and planning how I'm going to do it, you know? And then I take that bite because this is the compulsive eater I am. I lie really well to myself. I say, you know, I'm just going to have a bite of that, or I'm just going to have a little bit, you know? The next thing I know, I wake up the next morning with a food hangover because that's what was happening to me before I got here. I was 100 pounds overweight, and every time I would try to get that diet mentality started, you know, the one where you're just going to knuckle down and go for the next big gusto, this voice, that negative voice that I have would say, what's the use? You have too much weight to lose. And because I was in another 12-step program, I had a friend who had made me a decoupage box. I don't know if you know what that is, where they paste all these pictures. And I was in school for massage therapy at the time. So she put on the top of the box this photograph of the reflexology points on the bottom of the feet. And underneath it, it said, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. And I was using that box every day for something, so I saw that. So all of a sudden, that voice that would say, what's the use? You have too much weight to lose, got drowned out by one that was a little higher pitched that said, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. So I came into a sister program. There was no food plan, so I didn't get it. And I had friends in my other program that they tricked me. You know, they were 12-stepping me into this program without me knowing it. They never said, you should, which, you know, as soon as somebody says should, I'm so far gone, you can't finish your sentence. So, but anyway, I had a call from this really good friend who had moved to Los Angeles, and she asked me how my food program was going, and I said, not good, I haven't lost any weight. And she said, you know, my roommate's in a program, and she said, called CEA How. And as soon as she said it, I have contempt prior to investigation. You've read that in the spiritual experience. I have it really bad. It's gotten better, though. And I said, oh, they have a food plan, and I've heard it's restrictive. I'd never seen it. So this is what she said. She said, well, my roommate has lost 60 pounds. Okay, now I'm listening. And I said, oh, that's good. And then she said the thing that changed me from that moment into this program. She said, you know, I think it's much like your other program. You go to meetings. You work the steps. You get a sponsor. You work the steps. And I thought, the light bulb came on. I could do that. That seems simple. So I went right that weekend after I got that phone call. I went to a 12-step retreat, and there was a woman there who brought a cooler with her own food. And they feed you at that retreat. And I knew she was in a 12-step food program. So I asked her about it, and she said, I'm in CEA Howe. Okay, what are the chances? And she told me where the meetings were in this nearby town that's only 20 minutes from where I live. I made a beeline that Monday. And at noon that Monday, one woman raised her hand, said she was available to sponsor, and I grabbed her before she left the room. And that was my beginning in this program. And like I said, I've had a couple of running starts. It's not something I recommend. It is easier to stay abstinent. But my story is different. You know, I didn't know until I knew. And so, you know, I wanted to lose the weight. I wanted physical recovery. But I remembered before I found this program, I had been successful in a diet program. And it was when I was new in 12-step programs. And I remembered that I stood in front of the mirror and I looked at myself in the mirror and I had lost the weight. I was wearing a smaller size. All the things I thought would bring me pure joy and bliss. And I looked in the mirror and I remembered thinking, is this all there is? Because nothing had changed here. I didn't know that then. But anyway, so, you know, I was really fortunate. I've relapsed in this program, but I've never gone far from the program. And that I highly recommend. And so when I recommitted this abstinence, I was fortunate enough that I found a sponsor who told me some things that have really, really helped me, you know, with finally admitting to my innermost self that I am a compulsive eater. And the second part to that step that always got left out for me is that my life is unmanageable by me. And what that means for me is that when I'm weighing my and measuring my food and I'm pinching off what is over the weight, if I think it's okay to put that pinch in my mouth, I'm managing my life again. So where am I admitting my powerlessness? I've canceled it out. That's my experience. So this sponsor said to me, I am not going to police your program. And she gave me an outline where I have to call her every day. She's no longer my sponsor. She was my inventory sponsor, but I do make outreach calls to her. And she said, the outline started with the today's date, my recommitted abstinence date, my weight today. We decided to add my top weight because I need to remember where I came from because life is good today. And how many days I'm abstinent, what question I'm writing on. And then I list my food and then I list the tools. And so I report to her, you know, and I can say I called so-and-so and it not be true, but where's that in step one that it says, you know, the principle of step one is honesty. So the problem I was having is if I'm lying to you, I'm lying to myself. There's a question in the first 30 days that I never really understood the way it's worded. You know the one, she's shaking her head. I finally got that. It's like, okay, oh, now I get that. You know, if I'm lying to you, I'm lying to me. And what am I getting from that? Nothing. So anyway, I really appreciated that because that made me accountable from my program. And she didn't need to say to me, oh, have you made your outreach calls? Because I've been sponsored in this program, and I'm not blaming the sponsors. That's not what I'm saying. But my experience has been that if they don't ask, I don't tell. Yeah, there was step one. So anyway, and then the principle of step two is faith. And it says came to believe. It has taken me, it's not that I haven't developed a sense of a higher power. When I came into 12-step programs, I had to completely change that old picture of the czar in the heavens. That was mine. And it's taken me a long time. I don't even have to really describe it or explain it. I just know it's there. How it came to me is that it started with a voice. And it's not the voice up here. It's a voice that's in here. And I call it my God voice. And it's also my intuition, because I can trust that now. I know the difference between here and here. And the principle of step three is hope. And that step for me, this is great. I was one of those people that after I would do something because I was in charge, I would go, I could ask God. It says I made a decision. Okay, that means past tense. Well, then if I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, why am I trying to do it? Why am I trying to run the show again? So that's a step that I have to constantly be aware of. In fact, here's a funny story. I said to a friend one day that I'm going to have that tattooed on my forehead, made a decision. And we started laughing. And she said, you know, I'm gonna have that tattooed on my arm. So what did I do? I went out and had it tattooed on my wrist. Made a decision. And I misspelled decision. It was accidental. But it's a tattoo. You can't erase it. So when I realized I misspelled it, it was hours later, and I called the tattoo artist and said, we misspelled decision. The lettering's pretty close together. So he said, I'm pretty sure I can fix it. And I said, you know what? I don't want you to. Because I can look at that word misspelled and know that I can't even spell without God's help. So the short version of the first three steps for me, I heard somebody share this in early recovery, and it's, I can't, you can, and I'll let you. I have to ditto what I heard Gina say. You know, I want the emotional recovery. And I've been fortunate enough that it's through my relationships with you, you know, people that I interact with, that I get to see what needs to change in me. I always have to see my part. And it can take a while before I see my part. But it's getting better. It's getting better in the sense that when I choose, it's a choice every day to wake up and be grateful for what I have. You know, that's the other thing in my writing to my sponsor. I have to list three things I'm grateful for. It's kind of hard to stop at three most of the time. But when I choose to stay in recovery and do the things that are required, I love that in this program. It's my choice, but it's a requirement if I want to keep what I have. I have a friend in recovery who's not in this program, but she's from Texas, so she's got that great Texas drawl, and she always says, this program is my beauty treatment. Y'all change me on the inside, and I get beautiful on the inside, and I glow, and you see it on the outside. I love it. And it's true. You're my beauty treatment. CEA Howe is my beauty treatment. And I, like I said, I came in for the vanity, And today I stay for the sanity. I'm always going to want that vanity. I loved it. Somebody in the panel for lunch said, I loved it. I went up to her and said, I loved it. I was a preemie. I was only 3 pounds, 7 ounces when I was born. I was in an incubator for a month. I said, you're right. No matter what that scale says, I think I'll be better if it's 2 pounds lighter, you know? And she said she went back to her birth weight. So I love that. That's it. You know, I'm always going to have that, but I don't stay there as long anymore. You know, I want to be that person that I never thought I could be, you know? I don't want to be right. I want to be happy. My sponsor in my first recovery program used to say that to me. And you know what my aunt, she'd say, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And I'd say both. I don't want to be right. I want to be happy today. So anyway, thank you for letting me do this service.
Hi, I'm Susan. I'm a compulsive eater. So commitment to recovery through steps 1, 2, and 3. And I finally made a commitment to recovery and abstinence the beginning of September of 2007. And I have been abstinent since then. It's well over 2 years I've been in CHOW. It was a parallel program, a very similar food program, weighed and measured, no flour, no sugar. My CHOW abstinence is the end of March of 2013. And, you know, it's amazing what happened when I finally made that full-on commitment. You know, for me, it finally was a black-and-white commitment to my abstinence and my recovery, and everything changed after that point. And nearly 8 years down the line of experiencing that recovery and experiencing that day-at-a-time abstinence, I've begun to ask, what happened? You know, why do other people struggle who are trying, who are sticking, you know, with the meetings and the, you know, and going through sponsors and trying to find it? And, you know, why did I have grace? Why do some of us have grace and, you know, have a string of days at a time of abstinence and recovery, and others don't? And it is grace, and it is miraculous. I want to have some understanding. And really, you know, some of all of this in answering this question and just being where I am in my recovery is being aware of compassion. My recovery today has a layer over it of compassion, of self-compassion. And that is such a powerful piece for me. I had a parent who found fault with me all the time, and I absorbed that and took it on for myself, and I, you know, just the way I operated was to beat myself up and to beat you to the punch. And I had, you know, what I'm coming to recognize is I had a lot of anxiety. I'm a very sensitive creature, and I had a lot of anxiety. Some of the main places where it showed up were around medical stuff. Travel. I traveled to get here today, and my travel anxiety came up, but in a much more subdued and muted way. There's a couple of others. Anyway, and this program has given me a way to have that anxiety and not have it completely take over. Or sometimes it does take over, and I get to work my program, and I get to have compassion for myself that I haven't been cured of all the things that ailed me, all the ways that I was imperfect. And with that compassion for myself, it flows outward, you know, and I have compassion for others. And I'm not going to find the answer that's going to help everybody become abstinent and be in recovery on my timeline. And my recovery today is based in gratitude. I am just so grateful for the life that in many ways is no different than the life I had 8 years ago. And it's vastly different because it starts with my absence, and it starts with doing the tools every day. And this program is the scaffolding upon which I build each day. And that makes all the difference. And it's that learning of acceptance that is talked about in many places in the Big Book and in our literature. And I'm not, regularly, I'm not in acceptance. But I have a way of finding my way to that, or knowing that that's kind of the goal instead of where I am, the addict fighting everything that's happening and all the people around me and myself. I've come out about 5 weeks of just a really difficult time. My anxieties were up around work issues, and there was a little kid raging, and I just kept on committing my food and putting it on the scale and doing my tools and acting as if I still had a connection to my higher power. It was a rote sort of thing, but it held the place for me until the emergency of the all the stuff that I was processing and dealing with sort of subsided. I worked my program. I came to acceptance. I came to see how minor every single trigger was. And, and I managed to maintain an abstinence and maintain doing my tools on a daily basis during this period of time. And one of the things I talk about that just, it developed, it wasn't a conscious development of it, but I regularly have thoughts of, I've done this long enough, I just want to eat some of the crazy food that I used to eat. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to spend all the time that I do with my gorgeous food, prepping it and putting it on the plate and all of that, and watching the time and not eating between meals and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, having some flour and sugar, why not? And, and doing my tools. I just want to quit. I mean, those thoughts, it used to be, if I had a thought like that, I knew I was going to follow it. And today, what I do is I just have this pathway worn back to step one. And I remember what it was like. And it wasn't only the eating behavior, and it wasn't only the massive quantities of I can't stop food, flour and sugar. Oh my gosh, totally sugar. It was the insanity that ruled my life. My higher powers were food, were anger. Anger kept me feeling strong. Anger pushed away the fear and that feeling of being annihilated, which is very much a part of my experience. And it made people at some level, they got scared of me. Some people got scared of me with my anger. It was big. And so it gave me that feeling of control. And the third higher power thing, maladaptive, was thinking. If I thought about things hard enough and repetitively enough, I was going to find my way to control whatever it was that I, felt had to be this way. And those are the things that I remember. I am maintaining 65 it veers a little bit in that 65 to 70 pound weight release range. And beyond my wildest dreams that I'm in this body. I got to go to my 20-year high school reunion 7 months after I found my way to abstinence, and my weight really flew off my body. And my mother ended up taking me to Nordstrom's and having a personal shopper help me find, because I had nothing that fit. And it was an amazing experience, because instead of, you know, finding clothes that hid the fat, you know, and I, you know, this is how I looked at things, you know, with this little thing. Okay, look at the shoulder, and I could look at a breast, and, you know, maybe quickly a hip, but, you know, never the whole body at a time, because it was frightening. And the experience in this personal shopper thing was everything that I tried on looked wonderful. And I had never had that before. And so then it was a matter of, what do I like? And, you know, how much can I afford? And anyway, so my mom offered to buy some. And then I said, okay, I want this and this and this. And, you know, it was a nice little wardrobe that I got started on. And she walked out to tally up the cost. And I just started bawling, because it was such an emotional experience to be in a right-sized body and to feel like, you know, I appreciate it. You know, I loved this thing that had emerged from me. And that was a whole sidetrack that has nothing to do with this topic. I'm sorry. Wow. Well, there you go. Anyway, thank you. So I go to step one right away when I have those thoughts of chucking it all, or I don't need this, or whatever, I don't want to. The addict that comes back in. And that leads me to step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself, and I too had contempt prior to investigation. I absolutely rejected everything about this program that was Christian-based, that was deity-based. I am sorry, this is not for me. I had been introduced to food recovery in the early 80s, and I knew that this was the answer for me, if anything was, but I could not get past what I saw as the religious aspect. This is a spiritual program. This is not a religious program. It is based from people who followed a Christian faith. And so much of the language is that, but that is not the only pathway to finding a higher power. So it took me many years of desperation before I became open-minded enough and willing enough just to stick around and just to read the big book and read the daily reflection, whatever the book was, and find the words that spoke to me that I wasn't rejecting, and stay abstinent and build that integrity within myself that allowed me to hear the recovery that was from a higher power. And for me, it had to start with just seeing the recovery in the rooms, the people who had were maintaining large weight loss and had that light in their eyes and were talking words that were just like fabulous, you know, and talking about their stories and where they had transformed. And I believed the possibility that this program could work for me. And I did come to believe, and I just had these moments, these little bloop moments of the weight was lifted off my shoulder. And those moments started happening a little more frequently, and then they lasted a little bit longer. And then I started just feeling like this is higher power for me. I don't know what it is, but this is change. This is me not having that tight grip. And the made a decision to turn, step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That happens moment by moment with regularity, because I take my will back all the time. And I go back to rejecting whatever it is, you know, because I don't wanna. That little kid comes out to stomp her feet. And again, I have the opportunity to turn my will and my life over the care of a higher power that really, really is the center of my life. And I believe that my higher power resides in my breath. I use a lot of visualizations as I was finding my way into really embodying my recovery. And one of them was, you know, recognizing that the addict is all in here, in the head, crazy thinking, da-da-da-da-da, trying to control it. And my higher power is here in my heart space. And my breath helps me to connect with that. And that made a big difference. The other visualization that I love to share with people is those cartoon characters of the devil talking in one ear and the angel on the other. And that addict is the devil, and the angel is that voice of recovery. And that really worked for me. And it's just a little lighthearted thought. Anyway, and the last thing I just want to say is that another piece of my recovery is when I'm in that controlling addict mind, I think about how tight my heart is gripping, you know, and it's closed and it's a fist. And if I offer myself the opportunity to let go and to open it up, and to, you know, to think about it radiating out and being one of love, it really makes a difference. And it's that too, I have to offer myself as an idea again and again and again, because I forget. And I think that's enough. Thank you so much. We do have another 20, 25 minutes so that we can have the opportunity for people to reflect or ask questions. So just as a prompt again, it's commitment to recovery through steps 1, 2, and 3.
I'm a big grateful recovering compulsive eater. I have a question and would like y'all to share how you use steps 1, 2, and 3 to stay in the moment. You know, because I hear that a lot, because I tend to worry about the future. And sponsors tell me, Lupe, just for today, weigh and measure your meals today. Put everything in God's hands. You're not that powerful. So what I would like the panel to share is practical ways that you stay in today, you know, one day at a time, staying in the moment, that might help me practice this principle in all my affairs. Thank you.
You know, the first thought that comes to mind is that my day is built on my food plan. You know, I commit my food the night before, and I have a general idea of when I'm going to eat my meals, and having that food plan just takes so much of that crazy addict mind and kind of shuts it down. And, you know, and that's step one. But it's also steps 2 and 3, because I could take my will back and say, I'm not going to do that. All that we're asked to do in this program, all the tools, our abstinence, our phone calls, our at least three meetings a week, our relationship with our sponsor, takes time. It takes, you know, it's a big commitment that we're making. But that, you know, we're not addicted to a substance where we can just put it down and turn our backs on it and deal with, you know, I don't do that anymore. We have to take the tiger out of the cage, most of us, 3 times a day. And that, you know, makes it possible for the tiger to run loose and the addict to come back. So I believe that, you know, that we need all these things, and that commitment to all of it is, quite honestly, you know, I mean, it's a circular answer, but that's what does it for me. And the steps 1, 2, and 3 are the background of, you know, how I stay abstinent is I remember what it was like. And I really don't want to do that anymore. there is a lot of damage in my wake from what the way I acted. And the only way I get to maintain this on a daily basis is through a higher power. And whether that's this program, which I do believe is divinely inspired, or it's with my relationship with my higher power, which is pretty darn solid these days, that's how, on a daily basis, I have a commitment to my abstinence and my program.
I think that's a really great question. I didn't really have the awareness that I wasn't my thoughts for a long time. So I was just always responding like as if my thoughts were truth, you know? And that's really been challenged in recovery in like such an awesome way, because I'll catch myself thinking about something that's already happened and like the little Pied Piper, you know, I'm off. You know, I'm like gone. And so the awareness of these like habits where I'm like worried about the future, you know, something that hasn't happened yet, it's a distraction. I've learned to look at it like it's just another one of my bad habits, you know. I don't want to say that like it's wrong to do that, because I think it's a human experience to reflect, you know. I think of the past that it's like evidence of my identity, where I've been, what I've been up to. And when I look back, I can get lost in fear or resentments, worry. I also can worry about the future. And when I catch myself doing it now, instead of going, ah, you're still doing it, I just try to gently bring myself back and go, you know, that's just stay in today, stay in this moment. And so when I catch myself doing it, the way that I call myself back in a really gentle way is just through my breath, especially in future tripping. It's the breath of anxiety, you know? And so that's so familiar for me that I can go there and like not even realize that I'm not even here with you anymore. So, you know, what recovery has taught me is to not, you know, even like snap the rubber band hard on the wrist. You know, it's more of like, oh dear, come back. You can be here now. You can tolerate being here now, because that's really all there is, you know? And so I know that the more I'm in the past or in the future, I'm not noticing all the beauty in this moment. And so I just try to sense when I'm not really here, and I'll go through my five senses. What do I see? What do I smell? What do I hear? And it kind of just helps me get back in my body, because I'm such an escape artist. I always just want oblivion. You know, I just want it to all, you know, that's still like a very fundamental part of me. But there's nothing so sweet as to being present. And one of the ways that I'm able to stay present is that the night before I go to sleep, this is a very practical tip. I don't know if it works for anybody else, but I'm still astounded as I'm writing down my food the night before, and I start to think about, not future tripping, but really thinking about what's going on tomorrow. I don't really write a lot of lists anymore, because I used to feel such an intense expectation of crossing it all off, and it was just like another thing for me to do. But I make a list to kind of download whatever is on my mind, and I'll go, oh, I forgot tomorrow's blah, 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 and I have this to do. So I might have to get up out of bed and just make another small preparation or a note of something. And it really does help me set myself up for a better day the next day. So I hope that's helpful. As far as the worrying and the anxiety of what's happened or what is to happen, I just feel like my best chance of creating a better reality is just to kind of be here now. So I do it through the breath.
Well, I do my writing at night. I write down my food for the next day, but my writing is a completion of my day. So what I've noticed is that it feels really good when I start to do my writing and I realize I've made all my outreach calls. That's the big one for me. And as I'm going down the list of tools, you know, I say abstinence. I weighed and measured. I called and committed. No changes. That's big for me, too. You know, literature and writing, I wrote. So, you know what? I love that. That brings me back to the day. You know, I'm going over my day. But I was given a really good, I don't know what to call it. My sponsor in another program taught me this, because in early recovery, I was in so much fear about everything. Especially, okay, if I'm 2 hours into the future, I'm in fear. And I would call her and I would say, I can't do this. This is going to happen, and blah, blah, blah. And she would say very calmly, do you have food in your refrigerator? Yeah. You have gas in your car? Yes. Is your rent paid today? Yes. Are your bills paid today? Yeah. Miraculously, they were. Then you're okay. I've never forgotten that guideline. I use it all the time when I get into fear. So, and the other thing I learned in early recovery is feelings are not facts. So when I'm feeling that intense fear or anxiety, as it's been talked about, I have to bring myself back into the moment and say, what's going on right now? Where are you right this minute? And in that moment, when I bring myself to that moment, I have it all. You know, I'm one of the wealthiest women in the world, and it has nothing to do with money. So,
hi, I'm Karin, compulsive eater. Hi. I've done a lot of writing about my anger, and I noticed I didn't get your name. Susan, you talked about your mom, and my mom was just like your mom, and I can't seem to get the anger out, and like it's like an all up here, and it's I don't want to feel this anger because I'm just not used to it. I've never really done it before, and it's really scary. So how do you get that anger out? I just want to just get it out. I've already done, you know, a lot of writing about it, and I continue to write about it, but I just feel like I just need another way to just get it out. Yeah, thank you.
Well, my sponsor can attest that I'm not done with that. And it's a process. And, you know, one of the things that I'm coming to understand is that my timeline is not my higher power's timeline. And just keeping on weighing and measuring my food and doing my program and having compassion for myself and that poor little child that just didn't have a chance, you know, and just trying to find a way to, you know, to wrap her in my adult arms, to know that my higher power is there. You know, all those things are part of the process, and it's not finished. And it's, you know, it's that compassion for all the people. My mother was a hurt child, you know, and she's got mental health issues, and God bless us all, you know. And you know, and just coming back to compassion for where we are in this moment. If I'm working my recovery program, that's all I can ask of myself. And, you know, and to know that I think that this is a goal that I'd like to be at, which is not be in resentment towards my mother. And the truth is that has shifted, but it wasn't on my timeline, and it doesn't look like the way I want it to look, which is just completely love and butterflies around every time I think about my mother and I spend time with her. That, you know, from afar, I can be in forgiveness, and then I get into her realm, and I go back to that little kid who, you know, that dynamic that was established from pre-verbal days, and, you know, that's all I can do. That's all we can do is just work our program, have some ideas of what it is that's still stopping us up, and then compassion for ourselves for not resolving it on our timeline.
I've suffered from a lot of chronic niceness in my life, and I had no idea until I put the food down how angry I really was. And most people in my life still don't know, but my husband found out. You know, I was married and finally figured out that I was safe enough to really be honest about what I was feeling, and it wasn't pretty. And bless his heart, because he really wasn't the cause of it, but he was... And he didn't like hearing a lot of it, but it was the safety of the relationship. And it's just so odd that that's where it came out. But it was the first time that I felt safe enough and I was in recovery that it was just so toxic. And I did get some help with that, some supplemental help with that. But what I discovered underneath the anger that was really liberating was that I was really grieving. I was really, really really sad about a lot of things that happened, a lot of things that didn't happen. And the grief process, I think, you know, people talk about it, but I think it's different for different people. And for me, it's still, that sadness is still there and I can feel it, but it doesn't take me down. It doesn't threaten my abstinence now because, you know, I think anger is such an active energy that when I feel it, I feel empowered. It's so confusing. I feel like it's almost like adding fire to the, like, I just want to blow everything up when I get angry because it's like the most powerful thing that I felt. But then I remember, oh, it's a cover emotion for sadness. And when I'm really in touch with that grief, I can also find that person, that little wounded part of myself that still doesn't have very much of a voice. And I can love her, and I can say no more, and I'm going to protect us. And for me, it is also a process, because I feel that anger is such a destructive energy, but it's also a creative energy. So I think to harness it in a way that is constructive and might take some help, it's worthy, because underneath it are clues for that deep healing that keep the food where it belongs. If it's not on the scale, it's in the refrigerator, in the cupboard, but it's not our food. So.
My experience, it too has been slowly. And the best tools have been talk about it, pray about it, and write about it. And that's what's worked for me.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. It was a joy to be in this workshop with you, and have a great rest of your convention.